You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later this hour, we'll find out about a crucial bridge in Green Bay that's sinking and what it means for the city.
Jim Henson is known far and wide for his lovable, furry Muppets who make people laugh, helped educate kids, and have gone on to have influential lives beyond their creator. Most of us know more about Kermit and Big Bird than the man who gave him life.
Brian J. Jones joins us now to help remedy that. He's the author of Jim Henson, the biography. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, I have to say I was a little bit nervous about your book because I thought I might be devastated to find out if the guy who created Jim Henson, you know, Jim Henson who created Big Bird, Miss Piggy, he had a dark, seamy side. But I'm glad to say that, you know, Jim Henson seems like a nice guy. Tell us a little bit about who he was.
Yeah, he's pretty much as you think he is. He's dazzlingly inspirational, and people really wanted to be around him and work with him and were inspired by him. And wherever he was, always felt very special, and people liked when he was around to work with. So he was, you know, this guy who did amazing puppets and figured out how to make puppets work on TV. But once he did that, he was more than just Muppets. He did really great experimental film projects like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, and did really interesting, sort of slightly dangerous commercials in the 60s with things blowing each other up and eating each other, and made his name on variety shows in the 60s, and then totally made Sesame Street a household name, was on the first season of Saturday Night Live. I mean, the list goes on and on, all these iconic things that Jim did.
He seems like just this walking vortex of creativity. What did people say about him, you know, talking about just being in a room with them?
Well, John Stone, from one of the creators of Sesame Street, said he would have been creatively restless had he lived to be 109 years old. You know, he was one of these guys who, it's sort of like a duck. It's floating on the surface very calm, and underneath they're paddling like crazy. Jim was always working, always pitching, always had projects he was developing or thinking about. And for everything that made it on the screen, he had, you know, 10 or 20 or 50 things that never got off of the page. He just sort of had this creativity that just constantly was working. It was always in motion.
And tell us about the birth of the Muppets. You talked about this creative streak that he definitely carried with him his whole life, but where did the famous Muppets first come from in their first form?
Well, Jim, the Muppet name came very early on, but Jim actually built his first Muppets and got on TV when he was still a senior in high school. What Jim really wanted to do more than anything else was be on television. Jim didn't really want to be a puppeteer. There's always sort of this urban legend that Jim must have loved puppets and must have played with them all the time as a kid. And that's not the case at all. He even said, I never really played with puppets as a kid. I never went to puppet shows. He watched Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, but then everybody did. So a newspaper ad was taken out here in Washington looking for puppeteers to perform on a local TV show, Jim said, okay, well, there's my way in the door. I'm going to go down there and tell them I'm a puppeteer. So he learned how to build puppets and perform puppets almost overnight, auditioned and got that job, and got into TV as a puppeteer. And then it turned out he was just so good at it that he just kept getting jobs as a puppeteer.
When did he first go out and do an act with the actual Muppet label?
As early as 1955. Well, he was in at that point a freshman in college. He had invented that name in 1955 or even late 1954. And that sort of became his brand name even early on. So they were always the Muppets almost from day one, which is really, really interesting.
And Kermit seems to hold, you know, that place of honor. And you couldn't help wondering, he was born in Mississippi. It seems like he spent a lot of time out of doors. Was there something there about Kermit being sort of part of him, about part of where he came from?
Yeah, Kermit's that sort of, you know, homespun, you know, literally swampy, you know, he's sort of that homespun, thoughtful person, which is the way Jim was. And I always said in the book, there's times when you could take Jim out of the swamp, but you could never completely take it out of him. Jim loved, you know, he loved jazz music, and he, even at his funeral, he asked that they play When the Saints Go Marching In. He always just loved that jazz. But Jim loved the outdoors. He loved to just lay in a field and look up at the trees and found inspiration in the stars and in the trees. And even in the Muppet Workshop, and they purchased this beautiful townhouse in New York to build the Muppet Workshop, and it was this three-story old townhouse. And at the very top of the stairway, there was a skylight, and it was called Kermit's View or something like that. And it was what it would have looked like if you'd been sitting on a lily pad looking up at the stars from a lily pad.
Well, let's look. Give a listen to a clip from The Muppet Show where it all really kind of came together. We'll give a listen.
Sylvester Stallone, 15 seconds to curtain, Mr. Stallone. Everything okay?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy as a clam.
I'm so miserable.
Muppets!
I gotta work overtime tonight.
Well, happy as some clam.
It's the Muppet Show with our very special guest star, Sylvester Stallone! Yay!
And a clip there, of course, from The Muppet Show. You know, one of the things I find so interesting about The Muppets is that the people who worked with them, you had these celebrities, they were on Saturday Night Live. The people who interacted with them seemed to have no trouble treating them like they were real. How did they reach that level of, you know, just being like a person?
Yeah, they were. It was great design, great building, and just spectacular performing. You know, Jim had the Muppets sewn. They called it the Henson stitch. You could not see the stitch on Kermit's face. They wanted to make sure you couldn't see that on TV. But there's always it's the purity of that performance that makes them absolutely believable. And you see it on Sesame Street. You watch clips on Sesame Street. The kids, you know, Jim's crouched just out of sight. They are never looking down. They are watching that puppet, and they believe in it absolutely. You watch footage of Rolf the dog on the Jimmy Dean show in the 60s even. Jimmy Dean believes in that character completely. Children would say, oh, that they would see Jim with Ernie, and they would say something like, oh, that's just Ernie's helper. They didn't even really, you know, click that this was the guy doing it. And on The Muppet Show, as soon as the puppets went up, they were absolutely believable. The director, one of the directors, Peter Harris, said he would call down to the floor and say, Jim, why don't you, you know, move to the left or maybe try that again? And he said Kermit would turn around and answer. And Peter Harris said, you know, at that point, it's just easier just to talk to the puppets at that point.
Well, you think about somebody like Steve Jobs at Apple having that control over everything around him. Was it like that for Jim Henson and the various incarnations of the Muppets, or was there really a strong collaborative feel?
Jim was the ultimate collaborator, and he kind of was Kermit in that regard. He was the eye of the hurricane. Things would go crazy around him, and people were moving around, and there were things going on, and there were meetings to go to, and things were crazy, and there were deadlines. And Muppet writer Jerry Joel said if it were a basketball game, the score would always be Chaos 98, the Frog 99, that Jim was always going to be just one step ahead of that. It was never going to be too much for him to handle. And he worked unbelievably long hours, especially when he was doing the Muppet Show in London. You know, he'd be up till 11 o'clock at night, and he'd get up early in the morning for story meetings. The guy just had an amazing work ethic. But people really responded to that. They really wanted to please Jim. They loved it if they could make Jim laugh. That was the ultimate compliment for them, is if you could make Jim Henson laugh.
You know, I was thinking about it looking back now, and it seems kind of crazy that this half-hour show was devoted to Muppets and tons of people watched it and it was successful. Can you talk a little bit about the glory days of the Muppet Show and why it was so successful?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons it was so successful is it was genuine family entertainment. It was smart comedy that didn't mind looking silly. So kids enjoyed it. Their parents could enjoy it on a different level. It was the place where you could go and see celebrities doing something they didn't do anywhere else. You just played the Sylvester Stallone clip. Sylvester Stallone sang and danced on The Muppet Show. you know, you would have Beverly Sills hanging a spoon off her nose. I mean, you just gave the celebrities this sort of free reign to do anything they wanted, which made that show so unpredictable and so much fun. But the British really embraced them even more quickly than we did. Jim was producing The Muppet Show in London. He got the opportunity to do that from Lord Grade in London, who really believed in him and really backed that show and really put his money where his mouth was. And the Muppets, in their first season, were gigantic over there. It was almost like Beatlemania. Jim even says in his journal at one point, it's this whole Muppet Mania thing over here. They had a bus that would take the performers from their homes out to the studio in Elstree, and it said The Muppet Show on the side. They had to take the sign off the side because the bus would get mobbed at the stoplight. I mean, it was unbelievable. The magazines over there would follow the Muppet Men, you know, Jim and all the Muppet performers, and talk about characters they were introducing. It was just it was crazy for them. I mean, the British got it early, and they really liked. They wanted to claim them as their own. There was one story that says something like, "They're ours. We've nicked them, and so they're ours now." They really liked being able to say that The Muppet Show was made in London. It took a little longer to find its audience in the United States, but not that long. But it was at a time when networks kind of, because there weren't as many networks as there are now, would give a show the luxury of kind of, you know, finding its way a little bit. Nowadays, they probably would have yanked it quicker. They would have yanked it. It never got yanked. Jim pulled it off the air. They probably might have yanked it and not given it the time it needed to really kind of find its way, which it did in a relative hurry. But by network standards, it was a little bit of a slow pace.
Well, as we go into a little break for news, let's listen to one more clip.
Kermit, about this Elton John.
Yeah?
I have seen some pretty weird guests on this show, but this Elton John borders on the revolutionary.
Sam, Elton John is a very important musician.
Then why does he dress like a stolen car?
Sam, musicians have always been fancy dressers.
Mozart wasn't.
Mozart wore high heels and wigs and silk stockings.
Hold your little green tongue.
It's true, Sam.
Oh, if Mozart wore high heels, wigs, and stockings, I'll eat my hat.
And give Elton John a big introduction?
That too.
Hey, guys, look at this great picture of Mozart Elton John gave me. What? Those high heels and silk stockings.
What?
Hey, Sam, you know, you'd look great in a powdered wig.
Good grief. I've been hornswoggled.
Okay, guys, come
a
on.
A little bit there. That was with Sam the Eagle and Kermit discussing the wardrobe of Elton John. We're talking now with Brian J. Jones about his new book called Jim Henson, the Biography.
And you can join in. Do you have a favorite Muppet or a favorite Muppet memory or some other part of Jim Henson's career? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking Muppets now and the life and times of Jim Henson, their creator. Brian J. Jones is with us now. He's the author of Jim Henson, the Biography.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your cherished Muppet memory, 800-642-1234, or go to our Facebook page, Central Time on WPR. Brian, we've been talking about The Muppet Show a lot. Obviously, another big impact for Jim Henson is Sesame Street. I want to give a listen to one of his main characters there. We'll give a clip of Bert and Ernie.
Hey, Aaron, what are you doing?
Hi, Bert. Well, I'm taking care of Mr. Hooper's store for a couple of minutes. And I saw you coming, and you know what I did?
What?
I made you your favorite drink. See that?
Look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Aha!
It's a tall, cool glass of unflavored soda water, Bert.
Yeah.
That's your favorite drink.
My favorite. That's for me, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Great. I'll take it.
Just 1 second, Bert. You see, first I just want to taste it and make sure it's okay for my old buddy Bert.
Well, I'm sure it's okay, Ernie. Hey, come on.
Spoiler alert. I don't think Bert ever really gets to drink that drink. Brian, how did that collaboration, Jim Henson and his Muppets and Sesame Street, come together?
When the original team was putting together Sesame Street in the late 60s, they wanted to have puppets on Sesame Street as part of what made the learning fun. That was the big thing Sesame Street was going to do. It was going to be sort of curriculum-based, which education shows really weren't at that time, but also sort of like laugh in. They want it to be funny and fast-paced and almost have commercials for things, which is why it's always brought to you by the letter Q. And some of the people inside Sesame Street said, "We got to have puppets on here, but if you cannot get Jim Henson, you should not do puppets on Sesame Street."
Wow.
He was that important to the deal. They got him, of course, and Jim created all these iconic characters. And what's really fun about Ernie and Bert is, you know, Jim loved that study in horizontal and vertical. It was like two competing different visions. You had Ernie, who was very horizontal and laid back, and Bert, who's very uptight and vertical. And he and Frank Oz, Jim does Ernie and Frank Oz does Bert, but in the first time they stand in front of a mirror with those puppets, there's a picture of them with the other character. And so the two of them really sort of had to play around for a while and figure out who was going to do what. And after the fact, people said, you know, it couldn't have gone any other way because Jim is Bert. I mean, I'm sorry, Jim is Ernie, and Frank Oz is Bert. Frank's very sort of buttoned up and uptight, and Jim is laid back and really knows how to push Frank and Bert's buttons. So they said that was Jim and Frank. But a lot of those routines, the other thing that makes them really fun is Frank said they would talk them around. So they sort of knew they had an educational aspect they had to hit. But they would say, okay, well, let's make sure we get that, and we'll talk our way around it, and then it was off to the races. They would ad-lib a lot of it. So a lot of that is sort of seat-of-the-pants, Muppet-style performing, just Jim and Frank Oz having a great time, and somehow sneezing your nose off into a handkerchief. It's educational, so it all worked.
Yeah, and it sounds like fun. Well, let's go to the phones now. Amelia is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Amelia.
Hi there.
What do you think about the Muppets?
I love the Muppets, and I especially, I am a tattoo historian, and I especially love the episode in the first season where there is a tattooed Muppet that kind of looks like Miss Piggy dancing and singing with Kermit to Lydia the Tattooed Lady. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with that Muppet and if you know anything about it and whatever happened to it.
Yeah, Jim actually drew all those tattoos on that puppet himself. I can't remember the name of that character off the top of my head, but he did draw those tattoos on that puppet. And you're right, it was Kermit singing Lydia the Tattooed Lady from the old Marx Brothers film, too.
Interesting. I don't remember that one. Well, thanks so much for the call, and let's go to Shirley in Eau Claire. Hey, Shirley, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I want you to know my two favorite characters were Miss Piggy and Kermit the Frog. I thought those two were meant for each other. Jim was my hero, because I used to watch that show.
Oh, well, those are favorites for sure.
He was super, right? The way he did all the characters, he amazed me.
Great. Okay, well, thank you so much, Shirley.
Brian, Miss Piggy we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah, Miss Piggy is sort of the quintessential Hollywood story. That character, that puppet, started off as sort of a back row character. They used her over in the UK for, I think, a Herb Alpert special. And then she was in sort of one of the rough drafts of the Muppet Show called Muppet Show Sex and Violence, and they had done a parody in there called Beneath the Planet of the Pigs. And Miss Piggy's in there, too, but she's not Miss Piggy yet. She's just sort of this nameless background pig. When they got her into the Muppet Show, they were using her there as well, but they didn't really have the personality for her yet. And, in fact, she was kind of passed around between two different performers, Frank Oz and Richard Hunt. So you watch the early seasons of the Muppet Show, her voice is off sometimes. She's not acting like Miss Piggy all the time. But there was one stage direction, finally, where Miss Piggy was supposed to give Kermit a slap. And Frank Oz, who had Piggy at that time, decided to make it a karate chop. And as soon as she hit him with that karate chop, it said the place just went crazy. They knew that was it immediately. But that's another example of Jim giving his performers the room to experiment and figure it out and find these characters. And then what's so great about that, too, is Frank Oz, once he had Piggy and that character took off, Fozzie was sort of supposed to be his big character, and they had to sort of move Fozzie to the background a little bit because Piggy was taking all the time and attention that Oz needed.
We have a question from Kevin in Verona. I have a theory about the answer. Let's see what you say. He asks if you can address where the names Bert and Ernie came from.
Well, there is an urban myth or an urban legend that they came from the cop and the, I think, taxi driver from It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, that was my guess, but it's an urban legend, huh?
That's a coincidence. Now, Jim did have a great uncle named Ernie, and uncle named Ernie and a great uncle named Fritz. But I'm not positive if Ernie was named after his uncle. He also had a great-grandfather named Oscar, if that is illuminating at all. But Ernie and Bert, it was just, sort of funny names that went together. But whether it was based on A Wonderful Life, Jim, they always said no. That was not the case.
Now, I want to skip ahead a little to the end of his life. He died young, and he was a Christian Scientist, as I understand it. And you write that he always sort of had the sense that he was not going to be around for a very long life. Can you talk a little bit about the final days and what that was like? We've only got about a minute or so left.
Yeah. Jim had a strep infection that he didn't know was quite so serious. He had been raised Christian Science, but he was not a practicing Christian Science. So that actually had no effect on his decision not to go to the hospital. He didn't go to the hospital, I think, mainly because Jim's a guy. One of the stories I tell is I got swine flu in London when I was researching this book and thought I was going to die and didn't do anything because that's kind of what guys do. Nobody ever thinks they're really critically ill. So Jim just sort of waited and thought he would get through it and had people at his apartment giving him soup and rubbing his back and just trying to calm him down, take a bath. And finally, he got to the point where he realized he probably needed to go to a hospital. And by the time he did, it was too late. The strep had just sort of ravaged his system. And you read his medical records, and it's just awful. He was unconscious almost immediately when he got into the hospital, and died, I think, less than a day later. So,
Brian, can you leave us with a favorite memory, something that we should revisit, popular or obscure, from Jim Henson's career?
I open the book with a scene that I absolutely love. It's from Sesame Street, and it's sort of indicative of the way Jim worked. They brought a little girl named Joey in who was going to perform with him, and they loved to put the Muppet performers, and especially Jim, with children and just see what would happen. Wasn't ever scripted. And on this particular day, they brought this little girl in, and they said, okay, you're gonna sing the ABCs with this little girl. And this is the little girl who started singing ABC, and at about every other letter would say Cookie Monster and just giggle uncontrollably. And Jim, if you watch that sketch, what I love about it is at one point, Jim very nearly breaks. You'll hear him kind of snicker, and then he gets it back together and continues on his Kermit, and it is just magical. This girl absolutely believes in that puppet.
Well, we are going to have
to keep her hands off of it.
We're going to have to check that out. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Brian J. Jones, an award-winning biographer whose latest book is called Jim Henson, The Biography.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out where to check out the best fall color in Wisconsin. Stick around. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later on Central Time, we'll learn about some of the best places to check out fall colors in the state. That's coming up in our Curious Wisconsin segment.
But first, we turn to some major news happening in Green Bay. The Leo Frigo Bridge, one of the most important thoroughfares in northeastern Wisconsin, has been closed indefinitely after a large sag was discovered on Wednesday morning.
The bridge is part of I-43. It carries about 40,000 vehicles a day. An investigation into the bridge is underway by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
Joining us now is Patty Murray. She's WPR's reporter in Green Bay, and she's been following the story. Patty, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
All right, so the Department of Transportation is reporting what they're calling a sag in the Leo Frigo Bridge. Can you tell us a bit about what's happening there?
Actually, the DOT did just hold another media briefing that I tuned into online. It just wound up a few minutes ago. And this sag is between 27 and 22 inches. I'll give you a picture of the bridge for somebody who may not be that familiar with it. It is a four-lane bridge, so two lanes in each direction. Part of the bridge is sagging 27 inches. Part of it's sagging 22 inches. Either way, it's enough to shut the thing down. And like you said, we don't really know when this thing is going to reopen. They did say that the DOT, the State Department of Transportation, is bringing on extra staffers. And the Federal Highway Administration is involved, obviously, since it's an interstate highway. So those two clues tell me it's not going to open anytime soon. That's speculation on my part, but if you've seen pictures of this sag, the bridge almost looks like a piece of ribbon candy.
Which is, the word sag is not, of course, what you want associated with a major, supposedly solid piece of infrastructure.
It does not inspire confidence.
How alarming is it, do you think?
Well, it's obviously nobody was injured, and that's the main point. I mean, all of our minds, I think, when we hear about bridge problems like this, go back to, I think it was about 6 years ago in Minneapolis, when the interstate bridge there did collapse and people were killed. So nothing like that happened here, thank God. And when I was at the media briefing yesterday, the DOT officials made the point over and over again that this bridge is not in danger of collapsing, but they want everybody to stay off of it. They don't want anybody to even walk on the bridge. They don't want anybody to go underneath the bridge because the piers, what we would think of as a pillar or a column, those are technically called piers. And that one of those piers has failed somehow. It's either sunk into the ground or something has happened to this pier. And that is what has led to this fag.
Now, can you give us a sense of just how important the Leo Frigo Bridge is to Green Bay?
Well, you know, Green Bay is cut in half by the Fox River. And so your east side or west side, for example, I live on the west side. I work on the east side. So you got to get from here to there. So it's going to take a little bit longer without this this bridge, because the other bridges through town, there are three more in the city of Green Bay. There is a highway bridge that runs through like De Pere and Ashwaubenon. But the three bridges within the city of Green Bay, kind of the down, what we would think of as the downtown area, those are drawbridges. So you never know. You know, it's still shipping season.
Hmm.
The drawbridge can open up, and on top of that, what we call in Green Bay the double whammy. You got a train track in front of the drawbridge, so you can have a train going by, which happened to me this morning. So you're stuck waiting for the train to go by, which is fine. It's all part of commerce. But then you also have the possibility of the drawbridge going up. So people really need to drive the town. They need to get an alternate route for the foreseeable future or unforeseeable future.
Well, this is part of I-43. People who might be heading past Green Bay, is this going to affect a lot of travelers who are looking to get through Green Bay onward up toward, I don't know, Door County or somewhere?
Well, that's another fun part of the story. Maybe not Door County, because you could scoot around this and easily go up Interstate 43, no problem. People who want to go up and see the beautiful leaves and maybe visit a few apple orchards in Door County or something like that, no problem. If, however, you're going to be heading up for, like, deer hunting or something, like toward Marinette, or the Upper Peninsula toward northern Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
on the west side of the bay, there is also a major reconstruction project going on for Highway 41, State Highway 41. And so there are some lane restrictions, and sometimes, usually overnight, there are even, you know, they're even closing off portions of the highway there. So there you go.
Now, you're describing kind of a traffic, I don't know, nightmare. I've been in Green Bay, but I can't remember how heavy traffic is there. How big a deal do you expect this to be to commuters every day?
Well, to commuters. I mean, I think commuters and...
Or just people getting to their jobs and their homes.
Oh, I don't think anybody's been impeded from getting to work. I mean, I don't think it's, you know, it's not to that extent. It's an inconvenience, but... You know, as I said before, you know, nobody was injured, nobody got killed or anything like that. So it's just something, yeah, you got to deal with it.
Now, there was, as I understand it, some construction sort of shoring up various parts of the same bridge earlier this year. So I take it whatever happened there was not enough to stop this sag from happening. Do you know what they did earlier and how it might have affected the sag now?
They were doing some deck repair, some painting of the bridge to prevent rusting, you know, things like that. So it was kind of typical maintenance that would happen on a bridge. And I did ask the DOT officials about that yesterday. I said, hey, you know, did this deck repair have anything to do with it? Because I remember with that I-35 or 35W in Minneapolis that... They said that some of that, you know, you're just putting asphalt on top of asphalt on top of asphalt to repair the roadway, the deck, and I think there was some sort of concern that that might have weighted the bridge down. It's too early to say anything about that with this Leo Frigo I-43 bridge here in Green Bay.
Okay, and last quick question. Is this going to mean anything for Packer fans who are trying to get to Green Bay to see a game?
I just talked to somebody from the Green Bay Visitors and Convention Bureau today, and his quote was, people would crawl to get to a Green Bay Packer game.
And will they have to?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, we'll have to wait and see. Keep us in touch about this one, Patty.
I shall.
All right. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That was Patty Murray, WPR's reporter in Green Bay. For more coverage on this story, Joy Cardine will be talking with Wisconsin Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb. That's coming up Tuesday at 7 o'clock next week.
Coming up next, we'll hear about some of the best places in the state to see fall colors.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
As we move from September into October, the leaves are starting to change colors around Wisconsin.
It's kind of the best part of the season, other than the return, of course, of pumpkin-flavored everything, in my personal opinion.
Looking forward to pie.
That's good, too. Well, here to tell us about some of the places in the Badger State to see fall colors, maybe you can bring your pie along, Rob, is Robert Zimmer, garden and outdoors writer for the Appleton Post-Crescent. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
So we've heard that the fall colors are coming a bit earlier this year. What are we seeing so far?
There's not much yet around the area I'm in. I've heard they're going to be right on time. They're just starting to turn around central Wisconsin here where I live.
And when do they usually peak?
They're actually pretty close to the first, second week of October. They start farther north, and then you go south, and they cycle through the end of October. But around my area, about the second week of October, and I'm in the Appleton area.
So you wrote a piece on some of the most spectacular places around the state to check out fall colors. Can you give us some of your favorites?
Sure. Some of my favorites are, I like out-of-the-way places. I don't like to send people to the main big places that everyone goes, but I like Horicon Marsh, which obviously isn't an out-of-the-way place, but people don't usually think of Horicon Marsh as a fall color area. They think of the geese and things like that, but there's actually a lot of really pretty color there. The Niagara Escarpment runs across the eastern edge of the marsh and then down to the south, and that's a beautiful area to visit.
What is the Niagara Escarpment?
It's the ledge that makes up Niagara Falls. It makes up the Kettle Moraine all the way through Door County. It's the big limestone ledge that makes up pretty much circles through the whole eastern half of the state, all the way up through Upper Michigan, makes a loop back down through Niagara Falls.
Now, obviously, lots of people have favorite fall color viewing points, and we want to hear what those are. You can add to this conversation with Robert Zimmer as we talk about some of his favorites. Why don't you join in and tell us some of yours at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, just like Jake did, and he recommends Devil's Lake for fall color viewing. Have you been there, Robert?
Yep, Devil's Lake is beautiful, especially a little bit later. The second or third week in October, a lot of beautiful scenery there. Plus, you get the whole the scenic view from the top of the peak there.
The tricky thing is walking on the bluff paths with lots of dry leaves on the ground.
It's right.
I have found
or
it
worse when they're wet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wet or dry leaves. I find it a bit harrowing walking with the kids up and down those. We've survived every event, and the view is spectacular. I agree. That's a great place to see the fall colors.
It is, yep. And there's a state park here near Appleton called High Cliff State Park, which is similar. It's got, again, the Niagara Escarpment runs right there along Lake Winnebago. It's got the high cliff there. Lots of those steep ledges that you're talking about, slippery, but just beautiful as far as the scenery.
So when you're at Devil's Lake, are you kind of looking down on the canopy of leaves?
You can, yeah, from up
you
on
can.
The bluff. Yeah,
that would be a different experience. I'm used to one
right.
of my favorite fall experiences is walking through where the trees kind of arch over and there's you're sort of in this cathedral of leaves and color. I've had that at Door County before, but it would be something different to have to look down on them and see just the wash of them below you.
Yeah, well, now that you say that, another great place to do that is Rib Mountain State Park in Wausau. What you can actually do at Granite Peak there is take the ski lifts up during fall, and you're actually, you take the ski lift up the mountain, and you're looking down at the colors. That's just amazing. And that goes on every weekend, I think, through the second or third week in October.
And one place I haven't been in the fall, the highest point in Wisconsin, Timms Hill? Is that
yep,
it?
I haven't been there either. Not in fall, anyway.
I've been there in the summer, and it's an amazing view. And every time I've been there, I think, I got to come here in the fall someday because you could see a long way. I think it would be probably pretty spectacular.
Yeah, that'd be beautiful. Yeah. A couple other places. Obviously, you mentioned Door County. There's a lot of beautiful places in Door County to go besides the obvious state parks. There's Cave Point County Park, which is a smaller park there right along the lake where the waves come in and create like caves in the limestone. And again, that's the same Niagara Escarpment we talked about.
Oh, sorry, where was that one again?
It's called Cave Point County Park in Door County.
In Door County. Okay, wow. Yeah. So there are, even though we know a general place, there might be an especially, neat, out-of-the-way place like that that people like.
Right, and that's what I prefer because, you know, you're by yourself, and some of the roads leading to Cave Point are just beautiful. You go down these winding roads leading to the park, and just gorgeous with the maples and everything hanging over, like you mentioned, the cathedral of leaves that you're driving through.
Again,
and that's just north of, oh, sorry.
But that's okay. Again, if you have a favorite place to go see leaves, if you've seen them from Tim's Hill in the fall changing, maybe along the Mississippi, some of the areas we haven't talked about, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your favorite place to see leaves. Or maybe you've got a picture from last year. You can go to the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR.
Now, here's something I wonder. I don't want to put you on the spot, Robert, but, you know, we always hear about Vermont. Vermont is where you go to see great colors. Do you have any sense about how Wisconsin stacks up against Vermont?
I think I've never been to Vermont. I've seen pictures, but there's areas in Wisconsin that either stack up quite well or beat it. I mean, there are some really beautiful places, especially in northern Wisconsin, around Marinette County, up by Copper Falls State Park, along the Lake Superior shore, Door County, obviously. I think we come close, if not beating it in some places.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Jeff in Green Bay on the line. Jeff, hi.
Hello. I was just going to suggest there are several county parks in Marinette County that involve waterfalls that the fall leaves are a great backdrop to the waterfalls, like 12-foot falls and Dave's Falls.
Yes, I agree. That's one of my favorite places to see the fall colors up in Marinette County by all the waterfalls. And there's a lot, like you said, and they're all within walking distance of parking areas, so it's not really hard to get there. Some of them, there's a steep climb to get down to the falls themselves if you want to walk right up to them, but it's a beautiful area. Like, that's what I was going to say, comparing to Vermont. The whole Marinette County area is just gorgeous.
And hey, Jeff, is that bridge closure going to make it harder for you to get up there to Marinette County?
I usually take 172 over, so
you're clean.
Not in my case. But people live on the north side of Green Bay, it might be a little more problematic.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jeff.
And let's go next to Kathy, who's joining us in Catawba. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How about you?
Good. I just wanted to say you really need to come up and see Tim's Hill. It is absolutely beautiful. And this morning, I think someone was talking about rustic roads in Wisconsin, and there's a rustic road right up in that same area.
What are the colors like, though, in the fall? I've been there in the summer, but what is it like
absolutely
to be up on the observation tower?
Absolutely gorgeous. I've never been all the way up on the observation tower, but just on the road itself, and then there's a couple of lakes there, too. And so the reflections of the trees in that are just absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like this coupling of water and leaves. It's something I haven't thought a lot. But seeing a waterfall with the leaves sounds just like a little bit of nature perfection for you right there, especially since winter's coming and it makes it more poignant.
All right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rob.
Sorry. I was just going to say, Jeff, who mentioned the Marinette County waterfalls, there's also a couple of huge flowages up there where it's called High Falls Flowage and Caldron Falls Flowage, which are just these pristine lakes. They just made a new state park there, Governor Thompson State Park in the Peshtigo River State Forest. But on that lake, you were talking about the water. Well, there's these huge granite outcroppings that stand up over the water, you know, 100 feet or more. And that reflected on the water below with the colors is just amazing. The oaks and the maples and the hickories and things like that reflected over the water on a calm day.
All right. Well, let's get another comment here from Facebook. Susie in New Berlin says, go to Grant Park in South Milwaukee. It has 7 bridges and it's a beautiful walk. And I like how she's recommending a walk instead of a stationary place, too, because it's lovely to just move through and see all the different varieties of trees and all the different colors. It's a fantastic idea. What about Milwaukee, Robert?
Yeah, but the nice thing about the whole Lake Michigan shoreline from the border all the way up to Door County is it's actually usually about a week or two behind the rest of the state because the effects of the lake actually stabilize the trees there, so they actually come into peak later than they do normally. So it's a great place to get down there and you don't have to rush. You know, you can go see all the other places and then go down to Milwaukee along the lakeshore and still get all the fall color. There's a lot of pretty places down there all along the lake. They have the huge weeping willows right there in Milwaukee that all turn golden yellow in fall, and it's just gorgeous through there.
Mm. That sounds fantastic.
Well, we have a comment from the booth here. Our on-air producer, Cynthia Schuster, says, last year I had a friend visiting from London. We went to Devil's Lake and Peninsula State Park to look at the fall colors. My friend was so impressed by the variety of colors we get here. He says he doesn't see colors like ours in London or in his home country of South Africa. So, all right. Internationally acclaimed leaves here in Wisconsin, Robert.
Yes. And that's because of our whole climate, the glaciers, everything has to do with that. We have a nice, Wisconsin sits right at that tension zone where we're between the southern deciduous forest and the northern boreal forest. We have a huge variety of trees here, and, you know, they cycle into their season at different times throughout the fall. So you start with some of the ashes and maples, and then the oaks, well, the oaks actually come last, and then you have the tamaracks, too, which are actually evergreen trees that actually change color and drop their leaves in the fall. Those are actually my favorite fall tree.
And, Robert, time is running out on us here, but you want to leave us with one more very quick recommendation?
I like Navarino Wildlife Area, which is just south of Shawano. It's a huge area at 15,000 acres. There's just huge rolling sandhills that go up and down throughout that whole area, and you're just walking among these, you know, towering oaks and hickories and maples, and the color there is just amazing. And speaking of tamaracks, there's huge stands of tamarack there, too, that change to a really bright gold later in October and into November.
All right, Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Robert Zimmer, garden and outdoors writer for the Appleton Post-Crescent.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the history of apples and what to do with them now that it's apple season.
We'll also talk to news guy Noah Ovshinsky about the top stories from around Wisconsin this week.
And is civility on the decline in the United States? A recent survey says it is, and we'll find out what you think and how we can improve things.
We hope you'll join us for all that tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up next, people suffering from psychosis used to think the CIA was spying on them. Now they often think they're on a reality TV show. We'll find out why after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.